This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Silicon Valley age discrimination. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend here. Here's what's coming up this hour. Good luck if you're of a certain age and looking for work in the tech industry. Here are the workers battling ageism. At the office, how to become an expert at walking into a room of strangers and networking. Plus, trying to draw more families to their establishments, British pubs are banning foul language. And companies that name themselves after businesses in TV shows or movies or just happen to share the same name.
Life is kind of complicated for those companies. They like it, for the most part. And some of them intentionally name themselves after companies from entertainment properties. But a lot of them just had that name already. And, and funny stuff happens to them, the real thing.
Spencer Jacob at the Wall Street Journal on his piece entitled, "No, We Do Not Employ Anyone Named Iron Man." He's here later in the hour. Well, for years, job hunting over the age of 40 in the youth-obsessed Silicon Valley could prove hazardous to your career. But judging from the experiences of technology workers roaming the country in search of job opportunities elsewhere, ageism is a universal problem in the industry. John Swartz is the San Francisco bureau chief at USA Today. He says age is the silent career killer in the tech industry. John, what have you uncovered?
Well, for years, almost for decades, there has been a thought, actually not even a thought, it's the real life situation in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, where anyone over 35 or even 40 is considered too old and much more difficult to employ. So the idea has always here has been we tend to skew much younger. And the idea was with more tech hubs emerging around the country that maybe if you move to those areas, you might be more employable if you're over 35 or over 40. And that's not really necessarily the case anymore. It's pretty much skewing younger everywhere, which means that it's not just a Bay Area problem. It's an issue around the country.
Mm. Is there actual discrimination happening here, or is this folks who are slightly older saying, you know what, oh, I just don't have that skill set?
I think it's a combination of both. I think for the most part, there is a mindset, especially among people at startups and larger corporations, running the gamut, that they want people who are younger, who are probably more adept as technology changes, who are probably cheaper to hire, and who will put in a ton of hours. They'll put in 18-hour days. They will slavishly work for you. Mm-hmm. But I also think that leads to kind of a benign discrimination where those who can't get the jobs notice it, and their pushback is they're going to file complaints with the state labor commissions, or in some cases they'll file ageism lawsuits. There's one that's been filed against Google. So it's a combination of both, and it's just a self-perpetuating problem that hasn't really been addressed by any company to speak of.
That's fascinating. We're speaking with John Swartz, USA Today, San Francisco bureau chief. His piece is called "Ageism is Forcing Many to Look Outside Silicon Valley, but Tech Hubs Offer Little Respite." I was struck by this guy you profiled, this Pete Dennis.
Yes, so Pete ran a $200 million division in the Bay Area for Hitachi years ago, 30 years ago. And there were some changes there. There were some layoffs, restructuring. So he moved to L.A. to continue to work in tech. Jobs dried up there. He then moved to Arizona, and now he lives in Omaha, Nebraska, where he's from. And everywhere he went, he found really nothing. And at the time now, he's still looking. He sent out hundreds of resumes. He's now working selling signs. It's just so strange or incredible for somebody running a $200 million division to selling signs in Omaha, Nebraska.
Goodness. Are these firms, say, comfortable with their in-house numbers when it comes to gender, race?
I wish I knew, but they won't tell us the numbers, and it's an extremely sensitive topic. So when I reached out to Google, Facebook, and Amazon, I've heard Amazon has done a fairly good job of hiring people and certain jobs. But in terms of Google, they have a group called Greglers, who is kind of a support staff. And Facebook claims that they treat people extremely well in terms of benefits. But I think that begs the question is, first, you have to get the job there to get the benefits. And again, these companies, there was a study that was done about a year ago by a market research company called PESA, the jobs and recruitment website, looked at the median age of the American worker, which is getting older. That age is now 42. But if you look at the companies like Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, it's late 20s to mid 30s.
Yeah. So what are you supposed to do if you're one of these middle-aged folks looking for work? Dye your hair, leave out your age on your resume?
One of the things you do is you either get out of the industry or you completely reinvent yourself through retraining, which might lead to another type of job in a non-tech area. I mean, one area I was thinking about, just made me think about this, was if you're in a non-tech or kind of a legacy industry like banking or healthcare, if you have tech skills, you could apply them in those other fields. So you could move into like a bank, work for a bank or for a hospital, since you can't work for the tech company or you can't get a job with the tech company. Or you could start your own company, which is next to impossible, however, because the funding to older CEO types or companies run by executives that are older tends not to be as plentiful.
Yeah, I was thinking dye your hair, change, don't include the graduation.
Some people do that. Some people have, sure. I didn't put this in the story, but I mean, I've heard of people who are trying to look younger. I know one of the things that they're recommended to them by career counselors is that they modify their resume. So sure. In a sense, you shave years off your resume. You don't mention any dates for your college graduation. You just mention your last 3 or 4 jobs over the last 10 or 15 years. You try to minimize your long experience, which is kind of crazy, because resumes are about experience, and here you're being told to de-emphasize that.
How frustrating is that, right? John Swartz, San Francisco Bureau Chief at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Well, after more than a decade spent fighting Islamic insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States Army is scrambling to relearn Cold War-era skills to confront potential threats from Russia in Eastern Europe, territory formerly defended by the Soviet Army. Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent at the New York Times, paid a visit to spots in Bulgaria and elsewhere to find that the adjustments to the new threats are wide-ranging. Eric, what have you found?
Well, what I found was that U.S. Army forces in Europe, after years of preparing to fight Al-Qaeda and ISIS extremists in Afghanistan and Iraq, are now having to prepare for a new enemy, potential enemy at least, and that's Russia. And so they're having to basically learn kind of Cold War-era skills that only the senior-most officers learned as young officers. But they're now having to teach a lot of the young guys kind of how to get used to a much more sophisticated enemy than they faced with the terrorists over in the Middle East.
Wow. So what's an example of a Cold War-era skill?
Well, for instance, the U.S. has gotten used to operating these big, secure bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. But they can't do that now because, obviously, the Russians have very sophisticated surveillance equipment. They've got drones, can home in on them. So the units are having to kind of relearn how to use camouflage netting and disperse in much smaller units and basically staying on the move. You don't want to basically hang out in one place too long. You can get targeted by enemy rockets and missiles that are much more accurate, again, that are tied together in a much more sophisticated way with the Russian military than they ever faced with ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
Mm. I thought, too, it was interesting you noted the European borders, of which there are many, and you said these troops now have less freedom of movement on the ground and in the air. How difficult could that make things in the event of something we don't want to think about?
Well, they're having to kind of readjust again, in that basically there was one instance where they were rushing ammunition from Germany to Bulgaria, and they basically ran into some restrictions that Austria puts on military convoys on the weekends, because they don't want these big military convoys clogging the highways with people out for their Sunday strolls and such. So again, you're kind of, it's a military that's trying to kind of get up to a kind of a, not a war footing, but certainly a higher level of preparedness against the Russians. But they're dealing with political realities on the ground with Europe that's gotten pretty used to the kind of the post-Cold War environment.
We're speaking with Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent at the New York Times. He's based in Washington, D.C., and has written a piece entitled U.S. Troops Training in Eastern Europe to Echoes of Cold War. And he paid a visit to places like Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania. How about the numbers right now of troops?
Well, right now, the U.S. Army has about 30,000 troops in theater. Now, this is a lot more than they had just a few years ago, because they've had to start building up again, although it's much less than what they had at the peak of the Cold War, 3 decades or so, maybe 300,000 Army soldiers there. That's still a very small number compared to what the Russians have just across the border. So it would basically be a deterrent force more than anything else. To let the Russians know that, hey, we're aware of what you're doing, places like Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and we're basically drawing a line here that no more in terms of at least the mainstay of Europe.
Yeah. And then you've got, the Russians planning some possible 100,000 troop exercise in September?
Yeah, the U.S. and Europeans are watching this very closely. This is called the Zapad exercise, the Russians are going to be deploying some of their best armored forces into Belarus, which is right near Poland and some of the Baltic countries. And there may be as much as 100,000 troops altogether, both in the western part of Russia, in the air and in the skies, all kind of coordinating this much larger exercise that everyone's watching very closely to kind of see what happens, specifically to see if all the troops that go into Belarus, do they all come out again? The Russians have used exercises like this in the past for pretext for going into places like parts of Georgia, Republic of Georgia in the past.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent at the New York Times. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Well, great networkers are made, not born. 48-year-old Pradeep Aradhya, a Boston business owner and investor, saw himself as an introvert for years, but learned to network after realizing it was essential to his success. He's now seen by colleagues, business partners, and friends as a master. His profile from Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger. Sue, what do we have?
Many people think about networking as something they dislike or something that they're innately just not suited to do. We took a look at a guy who long behaved like an introvert, a software engineer who actually managed to learn to be an ace networker. How did he do that? How did he set his style and learn the skills needed to be a good conversationalist who can really meet strangers and make beneficial contacts?
Why did he want to do this, Sue?
He was rising in the tech world in Boston and he started his own company for one thing, which as it grew needed more employees and more resources. And he also began investing in new ventures, and he was always looking for new opportunities to invest in promising new companies. So both of those things created kind of a nonstop need for employee services, contacts, resources, ideas. And so his network became an essential part of success.
Interesting. So here he is trying to become a tech entrepreneur, or which he is, and then suddenly he's like a master of networking along the way.
Right. This is, he kind of brought out some skills that he had all along but really hadn't capitalized on. When he came up through academia and training as a software engineer, and his first jobs were kind of back of the shop jobs where he'd work out the technology and then the marketing, and creative people would go out and present it. He saw these things happening at a big ad agency where he worked, and he decided he wanted to learn those people skills too. And he took it on himself to learn how to use humor, how to dress in a more interesting, stylish way, and how to really enjoy meeting strangers and making productive contact, which is something that not everybody can do.
So what exactly did he do?
First of all, he started to change his clothing style. He had always dressed in the dark suits and, you know, very button-down look, standing in the background, being the engineer type. And he decided he wanted to dress in more interesting fabrics and colors. He window shopped, he looked online, he bought jackets that were more stylish, really designer shoes that were kind of a conversation piece, and he really began to look better. He looked more au courant in terms of how he dressed. He also learned to use his sense of humor, which came out naturally with his friends. He learned to use it in professional settings in a really thoughtful way, not just cracking canned jokes, but noticing humor in the shared surroundings or the situation you're in with other people and making observing humorous things about that so that everybody can join in the humor. And this enabled him to make more friends, and he also began having a better time.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. She's written a piece entitled From Wallflower to Expert Networker. So what would he say that this has done for him since this transformation?
A couple of things. It's first advanced him professionally. He's found many more good contacts, ventures in which to invest. He's able to carry new ideas back to his company. And he also is enjoying himself more. Interestingly enough, he really has learned to like the networking that once was very scary for him. He had to force himself at first to go out and shake hands and present himself as somebody who had something to offer. Now he's realized that he really does have something to offer. And these are skills that a lot of people need to learn as they come into a new career, particularly if they're trained in technology.
Explain what he does when he's in a room, and he's kind of by himself, but he wants to join a group discussion.
When he comes in, let's say he maybe doesn't really see anybody he knows well. He looks for what he calls the power center, people who look like they're engaged in a lively discussion and are fairly prosperous or confident. And he moves up to the group and just edges toward them and perhaps listens for a while if it presents itself that way. He doesn't barge in and change the subject to himself, which he sees a lot of people do, and then they get rejected. After he gets the context and has shown respect by listening and understanding the people who are involved, he might break in either with a little humorous observation or turn the direction in the conversation in the direction he wants to go about a topic he wants to discuss or some new development. And that usually succeeds pretty well for him because people understand that he's approached them with respect. Hmm. And he's interested in them as well as trying to get something for himself.
Thanks, Sue. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. She writes the Work and Family column. By the way, don't forget we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we use the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Glad you could be with us. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, how to practice safe internet when on vacation this month. Also, companies that share a name with a fictional firm from a TV show or a movie. Does Vandalay Industries ring a bell, you Seinfeld fans? And why scores of British pubs are banning swearing? That story in about 20 minutes. Well, the beginning of a new school year is right around the corner for millions of kids, and it can be challenging for all children, but it's especially stressful for families with children who struggle with things like reading and writing, math, maybe focus, even organizational skills. So the Ad Council and a group called Understood.org have joined together to promote ways children and their families can be first day ready. Kevin Hager is managing director of Understood.org. He's with us now. Kevin, explain first off what Understood.org does.
Yeah, one in five kids in the United States have a learning or attention issue like dyslexia or ADHD. 15 nonprofits came together and said, we can do better to help these kids. So we created Understood.org to help their parents navigate this journey, make sure their children with learning and attention issues can really thrive.
Very good. This is going to sound smug, but it's something I ask a lot of folks like yourself who work in this industry. And like, where were these kids when I was growing up? Like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I went to Catholic school, and I suspect the nuns or the brothers who taught me like would try to smack that out of you, you know, in certain circumstances.
I actually went to Catholic school when I was younger as well. I have learning and attention issues myself. And the hardest thing was it took years before they figured out what was going on with me. I kind of persistently underperformed. They knew I was smart but couldn't figure out what was going on. Mm. Now we know. We know these issues are brain-based, and we know how to help these kids. So the good news is there's a lot more research and awareness than there was, you know, 15 or 20 years ago.
Right. All right. So explain what you guys are doing here with this with the First Day Ready Guide.
Yeah, back to school can be a tough time for all kids and their parents, particularly for kids with learning and attention issues. It can be incredibly stressful. So we've created something at understood.org/firstdayready to make sure parents have everything they need for back to school time. You just tell us three simple answers about your child, and we'll give you dozens of personalized resources, everything from how to create a homework station in your house to make sure your child stays focused during homework time, to how to make sure, you know, your child gets started off on the right foot with their teacher.
Mm. All right, so explain that. Day one, new teacher, maybe even a new school. What's a kid to do?
Yeah, it can be really confusing, sometimes a little overwhelming. The best thing you can do is reach out to your child's teacher before the first day of school. Make sure they know kind of what your child struggles with, what they're good at, and that you start off on the same page with your child's teacher. It's never too late, though. We always tell parents, you know, talk to the teacher before there's an issue so that the first time you're connecting is around something positive.
Interesting. Very good. We're speaking with Kevin Hager. He's managing director of understood.org, talking about an awareness campaign called First Day Ready for kids who are about to go to school, start the school year, and may have some, say, focus or reading and writing issues. Explain the homework station before we wrap up here. What are a couple of suggestions?
Yeah, for me, homework time was the hardest time of the day, staying focused. This way you have one place you always know in that area. That's where you do homework. You keep your supplies there. They're always there. It stays organized. It really helps kids to focus more effectively.
And you don't do anything else there. You just do your homework there.
That's just for homework time, yeah.
Very good. Good luck with the campaign. Thanks for spending a few minutes. Good talking to you. It's Kevin Hager. He's the managing director of understood.org, and their kit is called First Day Ready. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Book your stay at Lexington and Red Lion Hotels and join Hello Rewards for future free nights and personalized perks with every stay. Before you take that August vacation, let's talk about the rules for practicing safe internet. The lessons are from consumer advocate Christopher Elliott, who got the word once that his email account had been compromised. Worst part? The notification came during a trip to Africa, 8,000 miles and 8 time zones from home. Chris, what happened there?
I was on the Kenya-Tanzania border a couple of months ago, and I had the faintest internet signal, and I got an email saying that my account had been hacked. And I you know, of course, as anyone would be, shocked that this would happen, because I like to think that I practice safe internet. I, you know, change my passwords. Everything's encrypted. And it just, it goes to show that, you know, even if you think that you've got everything battened down and completely secure, you're not. And the thing that I suspected happened was that I was using an open network at the airport, and that someone had managed to find a password.
And they created some sort of fake network that looked legit? Is that what you think?
Yeah, and that happens often, actually. If you go on to, if you're at the airport or the train station or the hotel, and it says open network, no password required, that could actually belong to a hacker or someone with malicious intents. And, you know, you might be giving up all of your personal information to someone who's then going to take it in and go shopping.
Mm. All right. So you mentioned the use of a VPN, or a virtual private network. For those who don't know, explain the basics of that.
Yeah, VPN is exactly what it sounds like. It's a personal private network, and you log in, and then it adds another layer of security and encryption to what you're doing. the upside is that you have much safer browsing experience. The downside is that it can actually slow your connection down. So that's one thing I didn't say in the story, but one thing I've found in using a VPN after I filed the article was that it kind of tends to slow things down.
Mm-hmm. Good point. We're speaking with travel expert and consumer expert Christopher Elliott. He's written a piece entitled How to Practice Safe Internet on the Road. All right. You also mentioned, let's stop at the social media tags of where you are and that stuff, right? Kind of basic. And then you mentioned only use HTTPS.
Yes. Okay. Social media is really important. A lot of your listeners now are either about to go on vacation or on vacation. When you're on vacation, think twice before posting something to social media, because when the bad guys are out looking for places to rob or for potential victims, and they see that you've tagged yourself at a destination, they're going to know that your home probably is unoccupied. And that can actually present a whole different series of problems, not just in terms of computer security, but in your home security. So that's one piece of advice that I would have is either don't tag your photos with geolocation, or wait until you get back and then post your vacation photos.
Yeah. Had that thing in Africa ever work out for you, by the way? You got that resolved, I presume? Was that a headache?
I'm glad you asked about that. Actually, it turned out that it was not an open network. What happened was that someone had gone to my website, my consumer advocacy website, which is Elliott.org, 2 L's, 2 T's, in case you're looking for help. And they had found the names of some of my coworkers and had sent them emails that appeared to be from me. So they were spoofing me. Of course, it took about 2 or 3 hours for me to figure out that this was going on. In the meantime, I thought that all my accounts had been compromised. So I was busy changing all my passwords. Which, again, always a good idea, change your password.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Elliott, consumer advocate and travel expert. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, companies that share the same name with a fictional firm, like from TV. Thanks again for being with us. Companies that share names with fictional firms from cult movies and TV shows can get into some funny and head-scratching situations. Do the firms Vandalay Industries and Initech ring a bell? Those are actual businesses. Here's Spencer Jacob, deputy editor of Heard on the Street at the Wall Street Journal, where he's also a reporter. Spencer, what's up here?
Well, basically, I came by accident across a company called Vandalay Industries, which Seinfeld fans know is the company that George, having to make something up on the fly, makes up a company called Vandalay Industries that is in the latex industry. And then the unemployment office has to call Jerry's apartment and verify that it exists. He gives Jerry's number as a switchboard, and, hilarity ensues. It doesn't really work out that way.
I was at the unemployment office, and I told them I was very close to getting a job with Vandalay Industries, and I gave them your phone number. So now, when the phone rings, you have to answer, Vandalay Industries.
I'm Vandalay Industries.
Right.
There are, I wonder how many of these companies that are in TV shows and movies actually have a real-life equivalent, and they all do. I mean, almost everything does. I started calling some of these companies up. First of all, I wanted to make sure that they weren't joke companies, and that happens to them a lot. People call them up and say, you're really a real company, right? But, life is kind of complicated for those companies. They like it, for the most part. And some of them intentionally named themselves after companies from entertainment properties, but a lot of them just had that name already. And funny stuff happens to them, the real thing.
Where does Vandalay fit in? They existed already, or they borrowed that name?
They borrowed that name. Vandalay borrowed the name. Another company that I spoke with, Initech, which is the name of the terrible company from Office Space.
Hi, Peter. What's happening?
We need to talk about your TPS reports.
Yeah, the cover sheet, I know. Bill talked to me about it.
Yeah. Did you get that memo?
The guy rented the movie and thought it was funny, and he had to name his company, and he called it Initech, even as the same logo. And they do all kinds of joke stuff, or they give people red staplers, and the boss has a pair of suspenders and things like that. But, you think it's funny, but then, they get hundreds of phone calls from some prankster sending out TPS reports all over the world, just faxing them, faxing them. They don't even know who it is. And, people see Initech and then they Google it, and they haven't seen the movie, and then they call them up and say, can you please stop sending these faxes? We don't know what a TPS report is. And all the companies get funny phone calls, and almost all of them, like, people will sort of say that they work there just as a joke, or, you know, or leave a resume somewhere and say, yeah, I worked at Stark Industries or Wayne Enterprises, or I worked at Vandalay. And then, you know, some person in an HR office somewhere will call up these companies to verify that this person they've never heard of worked there. Sometimes they have fun with it.
Go back to that Vandalay Industries, because you made an interesting point in that some people, I guess, put it on a resume as a joke. Some people are really fraudulent, trying to list any company as them having experience there. But there are actual real former employees of Vandalay Industries, right, listing this on their resume as work history, who struggle as well.
A couple of companies told me that. So, yeah, they'll get, you know, somebody work there, and it's a small IT consulting firm, and then go and apply somewhere else. They'll be like, come on, really? Like, you know, and they'll call them and say, are you a real company? Like, yeah, we are. Like, they have to convince them that they actually exist, that they're legitimate company, that the person didn't just put Vandalay Industries and they're not just calling their friend's apartment or something like that.
Great story. Wall Street Journal Deputy Editor Spencer Jacob on Heard on the Street, also a reporter at the paper. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. We'll wrap things up with this. An 18th century pub in London called the Cock Tavern recently banned the use of expletives. Samuel Smith Old Brewery, the 250-year-old brewery that operates the Cock Tavern and more than 200 other pubs across Britain, has instituted a zero-tolerance policy against swearing, the first time a British pub chain has sought an official ban, at least according to pub historians. The Wall Street Journal says the anti-profanity push, intended to lure families, is the latest chapter in a decades-long shift in British drinking culture that has transformed thousands of traditional beer houses into establishments serving high-end food and craft beer. Some say profanity helps convey emotion during storytelling, or should be okay as long as you're not swearing at somebody. The English are proud of the range of their profane vernacular, by the way. A popular book is called Rogers Profanosaurus. It's a 600-something page dictionary of about 12,000 profanities that commentators say is a whistle-stop tour of the most disgusting expressions the language has to offer. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.